the Bushmen in the Sahel, which is that brutally hot area of sub-Sahara Africa, traditionally worshipped the moon god. In the north, primitive people tended to worship the sun. The sun brought light, brought heat, the day. But in those furnace-like areas, the sun is a brutal god, cruel god. It is the night which is cool and renewing, and the moon provides the light by which man can be abroad. The moon god is the creator god to the bush people, created the first man and established the first villages. And according to one of their legends, once a man had been created and the village had been established, the moon god watched benevolently over his creation to see them grow and develop and fill up the earth, to follow what would happen. And as she watched the man grow and mature and then begin to age, it suddenly occurred to the moon god that she might have done man a disservice by not informing him that beyond death there is life, and man might be afraid of what lies beyond his death. And so she summoned her most reliable courtier, the tortoise, and she carefully instructed the tortoise to bring to man the knowledge, the message, that beyond death there is life. And the tortoise set out on its steady, if somewhat cumbersome, way. The days passed. Man grew older and older. The tortoise had not yet arrived with its message. And the moon god, a kindly god, became concerned that the message might not get to the village quickly enough before the first death. And so she summoned the swiftest of all her courtiers, the hare, an unreliable messenger, to be sure, because the hare is easily distracted, but the fastest of all the people in her court. And she instructed the hare very carefully with a message that beyond death, there is life. And the hare set out quickly to bring the message. But as is the wont with the hare, quickly the hare was distracted from its fast, precipitous journey. There was a beautiful garden over here, and began to think that it was hungry, and went over to feast in the garden. And a little beyond that, there was a lovely, clear pool of cool waters, and the hare knew that it was thirsty, thought again of its stomach and of the joys that would come from drinking. And though the hare made swift passage towards the village, much quicker passage than the tortoise, it became preoccupied with its own needs, its own pleasures, its own satisfactions. And when it arrived in the village, and it was the first of the two messengers to arrive, the message had become garbled. It had forgotten the message. And instead of telling man that beyond death there is life, it told the man that beyond death there is no life. And later that day, when the tortoise lumbered finally into the village with the true message, that beyond death there is life, the seeds of doubt had already been planted in the soul of man. And though man tended to trust the tortoise, man was not quite sure. Is there life beyond death? All of the classic religions of the West, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, in their basic forms have insisted that beyond death there is life. The dust returns to the earth as it was, the spirit returns to God who gave it. And yet, if one looks carefully at least at the biblical tradition, there were those in biblical times who listened to the hare. We find in the book of Job that Job says, as the cloud is consumed and vanishes, so he who goes down to the pit shall not come up again. Is there life beyond death? Many would like to believe. Many feel that somehow belief in some life beyond the grave would make the approach of death easier to take. I would remind you that in medieval times, when everyone believed in life after death, that the approach of death was really no easier than it is in our more questioning times. There were in those ages people with very sophisticated ideas about immortality, the great philosophers Maimonides and Thomas Aquinas and the Arabs like Averroes. And the average simple person has a very simple and rather naive ideas about physical resurrection, about, you know, belief of some heaven in which all of his most fervent and perfervid dreams would be concretized and become reality. And yet there was no one who really doubted. Still, when we read this literature, it's striking how many customs and there were in order to try and ward off the approach of the Malach HaMoves, of the angel of death. Presumably, if there's life beyond death, there's nothing to fear in death. And yet, they sat up all night beside the bedsides, saying psalms in order to ward off the evil spirit. They produced amulets, and they produced charms, and Kabbalistic incantations of all kinds. And such literature as we have, which is autobiographic, which describes the death scenes of Middle Ages, indicate quite clearly that just as many people took death calmly, and just as many people took death angrily, as we might find in any contemporary situation. Some weeks ago, a young lady came to me and spoke of the beautiful way, as she put it, in which a friend of hers was facing terminal illness. Her friend had cancer. She seemed resigned. She seemed calm. The one who came to talk to me was absolutely overwhelmed by the spirit, the courage, the stoicism of this woman, the grace. And she said, "Would that I had the kind of belief that she has, that there is life beyond the grave." And yet, there is no assurance that simply because we have such a faith, that the onset of death, when it comes, will come more easily to us. One observation which I frankly had not expected from the rabbinate is this, that in all the times that I have been with those who face death, we all face death, but those who know that they are under a rather immediate sentence, I have yet to have anyone linger long over the question, you know, what will happen to me after I die? We talk of many things, but mostly of what I'm leaving behind, of my family, of their needs, of my business or profession and its needs, of hopes that I had will not be completed. We talk of what is being left behind, the past and the present. It's as if once the onset of death has come to seem natural, that which will be, the fears diminish, and the subject is not deeply considered. I don't think that we need fear that we will be any more able or less able to face the inevitable when our time comes, because we do or we do not have a strong faith in some life beyond the grave. How we face it, death that is, will determine in largest degree in how we are at that moment. Whether we have gone through the stages of anger and of denial and of depression, whether our spirit has calmed or we're still very angry at the fate that has struck us down. It depends on our circumstance, on our time, on our emotional makeup, and very little on our theology, very little on our theosophy and what we believe about what lies beyond the bourne of time. Now, if medieval man, our ancestors, believed universally in life after death, doubt began to enter our world in the late 17th and during the 18th century, when the Age of Reason dawned, and a number of men, encyclopedias, and philosophers began to challenge in the name of reason the inherited traditions, what they often called the superstitions of the past, all that medieval man had accepted on faith. And here and there in France and Germany and England, men arose who laughed and mocked at all the talk about some life beyond the grave. They said, there is only this life. When Voltaire uttered many of his heresies against the church fathers ranted and raved, and they said that his soul would burn in hell. And Voltaire simply laughed. For if one has no belief in the fires of hell, the threat of burning there hardly is one which is overwhelming or frightening. It was the individual man of reason in the 18th century who broke with the tradition about life after death. But in the 19th century, these ideas, this uncertainty became more pervasive. The area of secularity enlarged. And as the 19th century progressed, there developed a whole ideology which insisted that belief in life after death was not simply a medieval superstition, part of a revelation, a church revelation which man could no longer accept, but that in point of fact, belief in some life after death was a malevolent construction by the priests of the privileged, who were determined to provide a rationale, a false promise to the peasant and to the proletarian, to all those who had to be kept in their place so that the wealthy and the privileged might have their rank and their place. But in point of fact, so Marx and his disciples claimed, in point of fact, faith in some life beyond the graves was the opiate of the masses, because it said to the masses, the real rewards lie in the next world. This world is brief, life is uncertain at its very best. Life is, in a sense, a qualification test imposed by God. The more you suffer here, the more you prove your steadfastness here, the more you will rejoice in what lies beyond. The more you have here, the more temptations, the less likely you are to merit what lies beyond. So do not rebel against your lot. Do not ask for material, false, unnecessary pleasures and luxuries here, but be satisfied with the promise of life beyond the grave. Now, in the 20th century, in our century, the issue has become infinitely more complex, because there are among us any number of agnostics, of secularists, of men of science, men of the technological age, who have a deep faith in the immortality of the soul. After all, the ideas that lead to this kind of faith are all about us, and they're very persuasive. Life is orderly. The cosmos seems to have some kind of basic purpose implicit in it. It is a marvelous mechanism. And in that cosmos, in nature, in the world of which we are a part, energy is never lost. Energy is indestructible. It can't be transformed and it can't be transmuted, but it remains always there, the substratum of all that is. And if energy is not destroyed, why must we assume that personality, life itself, disappears and can be blotted out and erased? And even while in our age there are many who come from the secular side of things who have faith in life beyond the grave, so there are many who have come and who are part of the religious world who have doubts, who believe that there is this life and this life only, and that what lies beyond the grave is forever unknowable if it exists at all. As proof of this, I offer to you the new Union Prayer Book of our liberal movement. It is designed to provide us readings which reflect the whole variety of theologies which are part and parcel of our heterogeneous communities. And this New Union Prayer Book provides before this Kaddish at the end of the service a series of what they call meditations, a series of readings to which we can turn from time to time and find there some appropriate sentiment which reflects our own feelings. One of these meditations before the Kaddish is called We Live in Our Work. It affirms simply that life continues as long as the memory of those who were alive, who were significant to us, remains bright to us. At this sacred moment, we turn our thoughts to those we love who have gone from life. We recall the joy of their companionship. We feel a pang, the echo of that intenser grief when first their death lay before our stricken eyes. Now we know that they will never vanish as long as heart and thought remain within us. By love are they remembered, and in memory they live. And further on in these meditations, there is one which explicitly affirms immortality, the immortality of the spirit. Early or late, all must answer the summons to return to the reservoir of being. For we lose our hold on life when our time has come, as the leaf falls from the bough when its day is done. The deeds of the righteous enrich the world as the fallen leaf enriches the soil beneath. The dust returns to the earth. The spirit lives on with God. Is there life after death? For most of us, the issue has become one of individual faith and individual belief. And the connection of faith in life beyond the grave is no longer a simple one with faith, and a denial of life beyond the grave a simple one with lack of faith or in a materialist philosophy. But recently, there have been those who have tried to establish life beyond the graves as clinically demonstrable. And that's why I called this sermon A Close Encounter of an Ethereal Kind. It's as if we now had the tools by which we could reach out into the unknowable and open up what has heretofore been a zone of unknowing, of ignorance. Finally, finding answers to that which up till now had to be taken on faith or denied on faith. One of the striking facts about our age is that though it is an age of technology and an age of science, it is also a remarkably anti-intellectual age, an age in which men and women are being encouraged and are encouraging themselves to rely more and more on unreason, on intuition, on feeling, on emotion, on doing their own thing without really considering what their own thing should be, can be, and how it relates to what others need and what the society is all about. A friend of mine told me recently that he'd seen a bibliography, a listing of books, which had listed 10,000 titles which had been published in the last 20 years, dealing with mysticism, Kabbalah, the other world, emotional responses to the spirits, mediums, seances, and the like. 10,000 titles published in 20 years. Obviously, these titles are published because they can be sold, because not only is the author interested in writing, but someone is interested in reading. For all of our vaunted scientific method and our vaunted skepticism, we remain the age of Aquarius, a remarkably believing time. And into this time, there comes the interesting figure of Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Dr. Kubler-Ross was professor of psychology at the University of Chicago, and she is a remarkable lady, a Swiss-born lady who devoted a good bit of time in the late 50s and during the 1960s to work with terminally ill patients at Billings Hospital, which is part of the University of Chicago medical school system. And in working with the dying, Dr. Kubler-Ross did all of us a service by explaining to us first much of the emotional pattern which someone goes through as they approach death. First, the angry denial, and then simple anger itself, and then an attempt to bargain with the fates, with God. If only you let me stay alive until my daughter's wedding, I'll die peacefully. And then finally, a deep depression, turning away from everyone. And finally, hopefully, we come to an age of acceptance. But more than that, more than the clinical work that she did, she allowed us to understand the importance of allowing the terminally ill to speak of their anxieties, of their fears, of their uncertainties, of their reactions. Many of us who face this kind of situation play a terrible game with the terminally ill. We act as if nothing has happened. We know that they deny to a certain degree what they have been told, and so we come in cheerfully and we tell them how well they look, and we deny that anything is wrong, and therefore when they begin to send out the signals which say, I'd like to talk, I need to talk, I need someone who listened to me, I need to pour out my emotions, my feelings, my anger, my whatever it is, we're unwilling to listen. We turn it aside with a cheerful, uplifting kind of brace yourself word. And Dr. Kubler-Ross has, through her books on death and dying, has made all of us aware that when the terminally ill patient needs to talk, the doctor, the nurse, the friend, the husband, parent must be prepared to talk, at least prepared to listen. And much of our unwillingness to let the dying person open up to us is because we are emotionally insecure with such deep and profound feelings. We're trying to protect ourselves, though we say we're trying to protect the patient from their own fears. In any case, this work was seminal and significant. And Dr. Kubler-Ross established a national and even international reputation as one of those who helped to break many of the romantic and false taboos in our society, which had to do with death and with dying. But in the last year or two, Dr. Kubler-Ross has become something more than the psychiatrist and the scientist and the observer, the keen observer that she once was. And though she has not yet published the book which she has promised, she has given a number of interviews and made a number of speeches in which she has stated flat out that there is now clinical evidence of life beyond the grave. Her proof, her evidence, well, dealing with the dying, she has often been around death, and she has noticed that however a person dies, however much in pain or in agony they die, within a minute or two or three after the death, the body seems to relax, to become peaceful again, as if they have entered a zone of calmness and quietude, and all their anxieties and their fears have dissipated. Her evidence? Some 9 years ago, a patient of whom she knew was declared clinically dead. And that patient revived spontaneously some 3 hours later and described to Dr. Ross how during this period she felt that she was outside of her body, floating above the scene in which doctors and nurses worked intensely to try to revive her, and how during that period she had a sense of perfect quietude, beatitude, and peace. And encouraged by this evidence, Dr. Ross began to investigate the literature, and she has made the claim in these interviews that she has found 193 cases in which patients have been clinically dead and have spontaneously revived, and they have described similar situations. And she describes their reactions as these: a sense of calmness, a sense of peace, a sense of floating above one's own body, looking down on it, the feeling that one's own body is whole again, that whatever the injury that has occurred has been forgotten, that if an arm has been lost or a leg has been lost, the arm is there, the leg is there. And finally, when one is brought back to life, the patient feels almost as if an injustice has been done to them, that they felt that they were fighting against the attempt to revive them because what they had was so delicious, and so sweet, and so calm. Now, is this scientific evidence? Of course not. It is the evidence of someone who wants to believe. And when one deals with the trauma which is dying, and with the ultimate reality which is death, one desperately wants to believe that there is something more than the finality of the moment, that all of the heartbreak and all the frustration and all the trauma of the moment could suddenly be erased. Those who have died, who for a minute or two have, or three or more, have been clinically dead, their heart has stopped, their lungs have stopped, and who then revive, do in fact speak generally of a sense of darkness, of absolute darkness, sense of calm. After all, death is the cessation of pain. And what do we do to explain the unknown, to explain absolute darkness? We fill it with what suddenly comes into our mind the minute we regain consciousness again. And what fills our mind when we regain consciousness again, what allows us to shape an experience, whatever the experience may be, is inevitably what we already know. We see what we're prepared to see. You remember as a child playing those games that used to be so popular, they would show you the outline of a very complicated scene. You were told to look at it for a minute or two, and then to turn over the back of the page, and there were a series of questions about the scene. How many people were there? What sex were these people? Had the car hit the child, or the child simply walked in front of the car, or had the child simply fallen down? And it was amazing when we compared, turned back over and compared what actually was on the picture to what we thought we had seen in the picture, how much our assumptions had dominated our observations. And when we're unconscious, come back to life. We have some preconceptions about what life is, what unconsciousness is, what life after death may be. And these fill our minds, and they allow us to shape these moments of unknowing. And it is that kind of shaping to which these testimonies, which I do not for 1 minute doubt, in fact, give evidence. Is there life after death? I do not know. No one does. The great traditions in their classic forms affirm life beyond the grave. Clearly, as Dr. Kubler-Ross and her investigations show, there are many in our scientific world, in and out of it, who want desperately to believe. I think probably most people believe in some life beyond the grave. I confess, I do not. But I don't know any more than those who affirm do know. What I know is simply this, and I close with a story as I began, a story this time from our own Bible, a story of King David. When King David was in his prime, his favorite son became ill. He had a high fever, he was deathly ill, he was on his bed for a week. And King David was beside himself in his palace in Jerusalem. He was shouting orders here and there, sending out couriers and messengers to bring back the best medicine men and doctors from wherever they were in the kingdom. Nothing was ever done slowly and deliberately. There were 1,000 orders shouted impulsively, angrily, bitterly, out of the frustration of the father's great concern for his son. And after a week, his son died. And the courtiers huddled together, afraid to tell the king. They'd seen the king beside himself. They knew of his power. They knew of his love. They knew of his anger. They were scared that the king would suddenly turn upon whoever brought the bad news. And King David saw this huddle of his courtiers, and he sensed what had happened. Without speaking a word, the Bible tells us, he returned to his room and took off the clothes he'd been in for the whole week, and bathed and put on fresh garments, and then he turned to one of his attendants and he ordered a meal. And he sat down to the meal and he ate and he satisfied himself and he was calm. And the courtiers could not understand the behavior of their king, and they turned to the king and they said, "My lord, while the boy was alive, you ranted, you raved, you paced the palace, you were in a frenzy. And now that he's dead, you're so calm and quiet." And the king turned to his courtiers and he said, "While the boy was alive, I did all that I could for him. But now he is dead. A fact is a fact. I will go to him someday. He will never return to me." What all of us know is that we are alive. And as long as we are alive, we must do all that we can for the living. All that will support and sustain and encourage and permit a healthier and more gracious life. And all that we really know is that in the face of death, of the inevitable finality of life, we must find whatever calmness and grace that we can manage. Grief is difficult. The pain of watching somebody whom we love who is terminally ill is a pain beyond description. It's a brutality. Somehow, we find within us, deep down, the courage to keep on. And more importantly, the courage to turn back from the bedside and the graveyard to life itself. Life is for the living. And of this I am ultimately confident. The God who created us all does not have for beyond the grave anything that might be harmful to us. Is there something there? I do not know. But of this I am confident, that whatever is there, whether it be oblivion, which is the lack of pain, or some other life, some immortality, it is for our good and not for our woe. Amen.